This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and I'm pretty confused. I mean, does McDonald's sell hugs and give away hamburgers, or do they give away hugs and sell hamburgers?
You paid with love, and that's all we need.
Your total is one big family hug.
Oh. Can you create calm in the chaos? The chaos of consumers. Good. Let's do it.
You remember McDonald's hug campaign, and there's digital visionary philosopher David Shingy, you know, the type TED talking, hey, the world is a story, brands are stories, corporations are stories. Are you getting the story?
Harley-Davidson doesn't sell you a motorbike. They sell you the experience of escaping from reality for a few hours and getting out on the open road and being a badass rebel.
Steve Jones, branding guru on Harley-Davidson. We're not just buying stuff, folks. We're not drinking Coke. We're teaching the world to sing.
I'd like to see the world for once all standing hand in hand.
We are transacting in meaning in the economy of ideas.
So it's all about the art of storytelling.
We invited women to be part of a research group testing a revolutionary product. RBX is a beauty patch developed to enhance the way women perceive their own beauty.
You aren't large, ladies, or plus-sized. You are just allowing the Dove Corporation to help tell the world that the story of your body is not the story of America's top model, some fashion industry-imposed story. No, it's your story with a little help from Dove. But when Starbucks suggests that people talk about race when they go to get their coffee in their new Race Together campaign... Well, what went wrong at Starbucks? Later this hour, a very provocative book looks at what might be a benign convergence going on between the values of people, the stories they tell, and this Kafkaesque conformity world of corporate branding. Maybe to simply characterize it as bad is missing some bigger point. But to help us with the Starbucks dilemma and other corporate initiatives, is this advertising or something else, is Al Jeanne, a professor of business ethics at Quinlan School of Business, Loyola University, Chicago, and resident philosopher at WBEZ.
I think there are four responsibilities of business, or three absolute responsibilities and one option. First of all, every business has to make money. You know, if you're producing the cure for AIDS but can't pay your employees, can't pay the rent, you're out of business. Am I correct, John?
Yes.
Secondly, you have to be legal. You have to abide by the law. If you don't abide by the law, you go to jail. End of issue, or you're sued, and that's it. Thirdly, and I don't think this is an option, you're required to be ethical. That is, you're required to live by the customs and the moral standards of the society of which you are a part, to speak in general terms. And the fourth option, I want to say this very clearly, is to be philanthropic, to be concerned with others. And I think that what Starbucks is doing in a very public way, although I must argue perhaps in a very clumsy way, is just doing what every business should do. That is, be concerned about the issues of society of which it is a part.
But I'm thinking there's maybe a deeper convergence going on here. Make money. Yeah, don't be awful. Yeah, don't pollute. Obey the laws, that sort of thing. But Starbucks seems to suggest that it has become a public square in these tiny little rooms.
Right.
McDonald's suggests that its transactions about Big Macs also have a component of family to them. This is much deeper than just the kind of corporate branding thing at the stockholders meeting and the live well and don't, you know, get caught kind of deal.
Right. I think he was correct when he said this may be difficult to take because you're confronting people. I know you're in New York in general right now, but in Chicago, the baristas actually chatter in the morning. It's difficult to get out even in a regular day without, how are you? Hope you have a good day. I'm in here to get a cup of coffee and run. This is stop and go, not stop, chat, and then go.
The key sort of question is, why does the McDonald's hug work and the racial discussion at Starbucks not work?
I'm not sure. You know, does the hug work because it goes, you know where it goes to? It's not just, is it a real hug or is the hug metaphorical? Is that easier to do? Is a hug easier physically than a conversation? Why do you think it works? Seriously.
I don't know. I mean, I think you've got so many people in America and in the world engaged in a branding exercise where they imagine that the story that they're telling is some broad humanitarian story from hip-hop people who are talking about, you know, get off the streets, you know, don't be a part of gangs, the fashion branding of Sean Puffy Coombs or P. Diddy, whoever you want to say, all the way straight through to Starbucks wanting to talk about race. Everyone's involved in this. And I'm just wondering if it's a kind of enforced hypocrisy, or are we really morphing into some fundamentally new kind of democracy that engages corporate ideas here?
I understand where it's coming from. My question is just timing.
All right. Well, then accounting for inappropriate sort of disruptions of the day-to-day life here, you know, do you have a message? Are you a storyteller, Al?
Yeah.
Are you telling the story of the Al Genie experience here? Is that what you are, or are you just Al Genie, the guy at WBEZ?
I don't want to hear your story right now. I'm just not there to hear it right now. Maybe 30% of this line wants to talk to you about race or will engage you on this question, but not me. Please, may I go now?
Franz Kafka would look at the Starbucks thing and go, right, that's the society I envisioned, where these corporations force people to, in ritualized ways, talk about things like race, but without any sort of human meaning. Starbucks would say, and maybe Malcolm Gladwell would say, on the other side, no. In fact, it's the Kafka sound. But in fact, people are sincere. And if they're sincere, then it's not a death force like Kafka would have us believe, but it's something good. Where do you stand here?
I think you're right on. And I would come from Viktor Frankl, who would talk about the same thing of Kafka, that ultimately all corporate talk, all corporate speak is an attempt to seduce us into corporate needs and sales and to have us march all the same way, et cetera, et cetera. This may be benign, and we simply have to get used to it. But right now, we're uncomfortable with it.
So the takeaway is benign but ham-fisted. Give me the latte.
That's exactly the correct phrase.
Al Genie, professor of business ethics at Quinlan School of Business, Loyola University, and resident philosopher at WBEZ Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Russian President Vladimir Putin sang the national anthem alongside thousands of Russians in Moscow's Red Square on Wednesday to mark the first anniversary of the annexation of Crimea. A year after that momentous event, with Putin and his supporters toasting their genius in pulling a fast one over on the international community, what did NATO and other intelligence officials miss a year ago? Major General Gordon Skip Davis, NATO's Deputy Chief of Staff in charge of operations and intelligence for the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers in Europe, says the taking of Crimea was something out of the blue, or you might say out of the old red of the Cold War.
The events of a year ago are quite seared in my mind because I had been in the job about 9 months. And we were very much focused on Ukraine writ large due to the events that we had seen unfurling as early as November the previous year. We had gotten to the point we were briefing it almost daily and watching what was happening between the Maidan protesters and Yanukovych's government. And then, of course, 22 February was a bit of a surprise when he fled. And then shortly thereafter, activity in Crimea, flights going in, helicopters, little green men, which we later called them, but unmarked soldiers popping up as early as the 26th and 28th inside Crimea.
Given what happened in 2008 in Georgia, why would we ever have believed that Vladimir Putin would in some way respect the territorial integrity of Ukraine as a sacrosanct border on any level?
Well, I don't think before the events of late February 2014 that we believed that Russia would violate them. So I put it on the other foot. I think that we continue to expect and still expect, you know, Russia to meet its international community obligations and meet the security agreements to which it's a signatory. And there are many which they've violated to date that are really essential to European security. Looking back and as we continue to try to understand Putin's psychology, I think now, you know, he's established a trend that has us all very focused on what he could do in the future. And so much of what we're doing right now in NATO and have been doing over the last year is focused on responding to which now is a potential threat that Russian military capabilities and then violations of sovereignty posed to the alliance.
Well, bearing that in mind, and also the words of your colleague, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, that Putin looks like he's, you know, signaling that he might be interested in violating the territorial integrity of the Baltics. What assurances have you given or has NATO given to Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia that the NATO agreements are absolutely inviolate, and that NATO would come to the defense of the Baltics under any circumstances?
Well, that's a great question. That's really been the focus of NATO since early March of last year. And we immediately embarked on a series of measures that we called assurance measures with a number of key objectives, obviously to assure those allies that felt most threatened based on their geography, two, to demonstrate the resolve of the alliance, to demonstrate the defensive nature of the alliance. In other words, it's defensive, not offensive, towards Russia. And finally, to deter aggression or threat of aggression from others. But on that latter part, in terms of deterrence, we immediately worked on a series of ideas to improve our responsiveness and our proactivity, and promoted those ideas to the heads of state and government last September. They were approved. And in fact, we're now at the end of a design stage of going through all those concepts and putting the facts and figures against them for the nations to agree upon.
Okay, I know you can't give away specific details because of security and intelligence, but are the principles, and I remember the Cold War, I mean, are the principles here, do they include the stationing of NATO troops on the borders in the Baltic states? And I remember in the Cold War, deterrence involved the invocation of strategic forces, nuclear forces, because the Soviets at that time had a huge advantage in the number of troops, just like the Russians have now. What are the principles here?
Well, that's a great point. First off, with respect to presence, what the allies have decided on is a persistent presence in the east, not a forward stationing. NATO continues to respect its part of the NATO-Russia Founding Act, which is that we're not going to station significant forces in the former Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact countries. And so what we're doing is basically ensuring we have the capability to rapidly reinforce. And the structures that are already there, we're assuring that they're appropriate to allow for rapid response and rapid deployment. We've also increased our training and exercise activity in terms of scale, capability, and interoperability, so it's more focused on the potential for a regional defense response if that's required. With respect to strategic forces, NATO remains a nuclear alliance. We have maintained our nuclear force capabilities, and we can continue to maintain the requirements for a potential NATO response if required.
General Davis says the Kremlin's behavior is part of a larger, longer lineage of what's known in Russia as maskirovka, military deception, which translates literally to a little masquerade, techniques that surprise and deceive the enemy in a way that in many ways is enabled by the Russian media and its ever-churning propaganda machine. Maskirovka, General Davis says, is something we should be prepared to expect once again from Russia in the future.
I would say yes, they're absolutely capable of employing the maskirovka techniques in the future. It's a systemic mindset that they have really ingrained, internalized for the better part of a century now. It predates World War I, but it was most, you know, well known in World War II and beyond. But their desire to and their ability to integrate all their elements of national power into a design which masks their intent, masks their actions is critical to them because they believe that that influences adversarial and the international decision making. So they work along all lines of effort. We would call them from diplomatic, informational, with their state-controlled media and propaganda, with their military, both unconventional and irregular support, and then of course economic levers wherever they can use that for their influence. And so we can already tell by their signals that they are willing to use certainly Maskirovka, but unconventional regular means to achieve their aims of maintaining influence in countries where they're concerned or they already see westward orientation or integration.
Major General Gordon Skip Davis is NATO's Deputy Chief of Staff for the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers in Europe. It's one thing to overcome obstacles, but what if your story, your personal brand, is to star in the special operations mission of your own life? You are a Navy SEAL in your own personal Navy of extreme sports, extreme obstacle races. We don't swim, we swim in ice water. We don't jump fences, we jump electric fences. Wire, no, barbed wire. On fire, that's right. Triathlons are for wusses. In the past year, an estimated 4 million people participated in popular endurance races like Spartan, Tough Mudder, and Battle Frog.
For me personally, I've done marathons and triathlons, and I enjoy those too. So I love running. But the obstacles, they're like a challenge. So you're running, and you don't know what's coming in front of you. You get to a challenge, and there you go. And you've got to, like, figure out, can I do this? How am I going to do this? And I think that's why I like it, too, because I've had to be mentally strong in life, so these obstacle courses help me do that.
Mentally strong, yeah, that's Deanna Hedigan. Maybe she should get her head examined. She's a participant in the Battle Frog, an extreme event designed by Navy SEALs. And while participants report that the competition is fun, it's also highly dangerous, sometimes even deadly. Luis Hernandez is a morning anchor at affiliate WLRN, recently did an investigation into extreme obstacle races that take place in South Florida. Luis, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, John.
Is this an adrenaline addiction, do you think? Is this a way of kind of making your life more interesting? What's going on here?
I think it is for some people. I think that these kind of races appeal to two different types of folks. And one of them is someone who finds running a marathon really boring. They want to run over obstacles. They want to climb obstacles. They want to crawl through mud. They want a little bit of danger and risk. There are people who they don't run one race. They run dozens of races. They travel the country finding these races because they need that rush. And the race organizers know that. And you have a lot of different types of races, and they're all trying to figure out the next obstacle, the next, I guess, gimmick to feed that sort of adrenaline need, I should say, the adrenaline rush. But I think the other thing, too, is this. Some of these races, like the Battle Frog, I think is a little more tame than, say, one of these other ones like Tough Mudder. Battle Frog, even though created by a former Navy SEAL, doesn't have the electricity, doesn't have the fire. The guy who runs this, Don Mann, he actually said, that's a gimmick, and I'm not into that. The other group of people that these races appeal to are those who are just looking for the weekend warrior. Let me put it that way. Someone who wants to just try something a little bit different, get a little dirty.
Well, it's not about, and to use Battle Frog as an example, it's not about athletics. It's really about being confronted by surprise, unexpected fears. Here's Don Mann, retired Navy SEAL and the CEO of Battle Frog.
The absolute truth is, for these races, and the reason they're so popular, you don't really have to train for them because most people don't race these events. A lot of people come out, and this is what makes it fun. They come out as a team, and they just enjoy it. A lot of people walk from obstacle to obstacle.
Watching the folks run across this, I guess, this course, and they can run a 5K or they can run a 15K, whatever they choose. You follow them. They do tend to run in packs, in groups. They come in teams, actually. I saw people, groups of 2, 6, 8. I saw a team that was a tent of like 3 dozen people, and they're all wearing the same shirt. I mean, they show up as a team, and they're all, hooting and hollering with each other.
Do these races give business to doctors?
You know what? Here's the interesting thing. They don't document a lot of the injuries. Don Mann of Battle Frog did say that in the few years that he's been doing this, that they've only had one person taken by ambulance to the hospital. But there's no documentation of injuries and the severity of the injuries because there's no governing body for this. It's just whatever they keep track of. So there are people who do get hurt, and we've seen everything from, you know, sprains to torn ligaments, you know, lacerations, and then, of course, you know, some more serious things. But for the most part, you know, it's not something they talk about. It's not really something that's discussed. But it does happen, yes, because it's a risk. You may fall. You may hurt yourself.
I've seen a number of injuries in the shoulder, the elbow, torn biceps from people who have done these activities to an extreme where they just, the tendons or ligaments give way. But I think you need to make sure that before you go through a ropes course or before you lift and throw tires that you've at least mimicked those activities. It's not just trying to do it in a really competitive environment.
Now, does Dr. Lee Kaplan there, the doctor of sports medicine at the University of Miami, does he say these aren't a good idea?
He's not totally against them, but he kept saying, look, if you've never done one, talk to people who've been through these and find out what every race is different. So you better find out what the obstacles are that you're going to be running. And, you know, then make sure that you do something that gets you prepared for it. Because he's right. If you're most races we run, you're just putting on a pair of sneakers and running. But these are things where you're climbing rope, you're crawling under obstacles, going through mud. Okay, you can't build that in your backyard, but maybe, you know, if you go to a gym, if they have a rope, do some rope climbing, you know, do some lifting of tires. I mean, do something that sort of mimics what you're going to be doing so at least you're prepared. That's what he said. If anything, make sure you prepare. He also pointed out, too, and other people I talked to said this as well, remember that any of these obstacle races, you don't have to do the obstacle. You can skip over it if you don't feel comfortable with it. If you come up to one of the obstacles, for example, like in the Tough Mudder, they have the one where they actually electrocute you. If you're not feeling it, skip it. You can run around it. You don't have to do it.
Which is very, very different from the language they use if you're training to be a Navy SEAL. And anybody who saw Lone Survivor can see that footage there at the beginning of the movie where there is not an option to go around the obstacle. Lewis, what do you think? Are you interested? Did you get the bug? you want to sign up for one of these?
I've had people ask me. I've had from my brother to friends ask me if I would you know, go with them to do these races. After having seen one, I would say this. I would have to investigate. I'm really not interested in anything that has to do with electricity, fire, or ice. You know, if there's a group that's going and I have time to prepare, I might consider it.
All right. Well, out there, folks, sign Lewis up as long as there's no electricity or ice. Lewis Hernandez, morning anchor at affiliate WLRN, whose investigation into obstacle races in South Florida you can find at thetakeaway.org. Lewis, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Franz Kafka's novel The Trial delivered us into a hellish world of mind control and powerlessness where the individual is a criminal and to stand out is to invite imprisonment and death. Today, while much of the corporate speak of branding and social values can sometimes be seen as another form of totalitarianism, if you blink, it can also be seen as a kind of emerging alternative ethos. Listen to this. Steve Martin. Is it comedy or philosophy?
I was swimming this morning with the dolphins in Costa Rica, and I realized something. I am a great man, and great men do great things. I want to open a flagship store right here in Philadelphia. I want it to be the biggest store we ever built. I want it to be made of 100% recyclable materials, and I want it to be so beautiful that people want to get married in it.
If I told you it's from the Tina Fey movie Baby Mama, you would say, well, of course, satire. But if you just listen to it literally, it sounds plausible. An epiphany with dolphins, a store dedicated to values, like a cathedral. Tom McCarthy's mind-blowing new novel, Satin Island, explores this eerie ambiguity. It centers around a corporate anthropologist named Yu, kind of like Joseph K. from Kafka, whose job is to write the Great Report, the truth of our age, written in a glassed-in office cubicle. McCarthy is interested in a modern notion of Kafka, with all the snarky satire and cynicism completely removed.
I'm kind of interested in the migration over time of a certain way of thinking. So in the 1920s, the artist Salvador Dali coins this term, the paranoiac critical technique, which is, you know, you take all these completely unconnected things, make connections between them, and you produce new artworks, but also new cultural insights, new bodies of knowledge. That's in the 20s. Then in the 50s and 60s, this technique is adopted by the situationists as part of this kind of revolutionary critique of capitalism. And then by now, it's almost come 180 degrees round, and it's become the driving logic of the corporate think tank, the brainstorming session, and so on. And I find these migrations kind of interesting.
You know, I wanted to play a little bit with this idea of the airport that goes all the way through through this book. You begin this book in the Turin airport, which is kind of random, and you talk about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico that all of us remember, the BP.
Do you know what? Actually, while I was – sorry to interrupt, but I was writing that section just before that oil spill happened.
You
bizarrely.
Are kidding.
No, I mean, that's the thing. It's almost like the car crash for Ballard. The oil spill is a perpetual event. There's always an oil spill that's either just happened or is happening, or we can safely say that is about to happen, that's only a month away, that's going to make the last one look small. I mean,
but
that's this kind of ongoing catastrophe.
You wrote with such detail about this oil gushing underneath the surface, and you must have felt a little supernatural when that thing happened as you were finishing this writing.
Yeah, it's kind of uncanny. William Burroughs used to think he was actually making plane crashes happen by doing his cut-ups. But then he'd I think he'd taken a lot more drugs than I have.
Well, the fact becomes fiction, the fiction becomes fact, and the imagined truth becomes truth. I guess that's part of a theme in this book, so it makes perfect sense that you would predict the future.
Yeah, so absolutely. There's the character, the hero or anti-hero, it's just this kind of node in front of this giant feedback network of catastrophe and spectacle, which is, you know, modern culture.
Have you ever been assigned a great report, an assignment that was supposed to be absolutely definitive that you determined as you got into it could, in fact, never be really completed?
Well, I think this is what we writers do every time we sit down to write the next book. I mean, there were two things I was kind of riffing off there. One was Bronislaw Malinowski's, the father of modern anthropology, his first commandment, which is simply write everything down. Everything must become text. That's what an anthropologist does. So the anthropologist is kind of a writer. The other thing I was thinking about was Mallarmé, the father of modern literature. Mm-hmm. His notion of the book to come. Everything in the world that exists, exists in order to end up in, or as, a book. And this all-consuming book would be so absolute that it would break the book as we know it apart. It would be a multimedia, multi-platform kind of non-object, expanded object. And so I'm very interested in this idea of omnidata, of the book to come. And in the 21st century, you know, this book is effectively written by software.
One of the great insights in this book is that, you know, people have acquired fiction and storytelling as a unit of measure. And it reminds me of in the 90s, you know, people would start talking about, you know, everything's a story, man, and what we do is stories. And, you know, then advertisers became storytellers. And I'm wondering if that is a conscious working out of this literary evolution that you described that really comes from the 19th century, or is it just this has been predicted, and it's not something that's just been appropriated by people who don't have anything else to say.
No, I don't think so. I mean, Western literature more or less begins in Aeschylus's Oresteia, 458 BC, with an account of a signal crossing space. The first 3-4 pages of that play consist of Clytemnestra not so much telling us that Troy has fallen, but describing to us in great detail the nodes and relays of the signal beacon network covering all of Greece, through which we know the news that Troy has fallen. It's about being immersed in a regime of transmission, of technological transmission. And this is, you know, this carries all the way through to, I mean, when we look at Hamlet now, especially in the wake of Edward Snowden's recent revelations, it's very hard not to see it as a play about surveillance, about, you know, the state scanning of private correspondence, data encryption, and so forth. So I think this is something that has been implicit in Western literature right from the off.
The Cold War gave us Orwell, and although they don't quite go together, one sort of predicts the other, but the 20th century was all about this big brother, this construct of the government as all-powerful, and Kafka's human being being all weak. There's something reassuring about the extent to which you're all just kind of moving through the same world of story sharing and data sharing, and there's just something a little more benign about this than Orwell's 1984.
Yeah, I mean, between you and me and your listeners, I think Orwell is a total lightweight as a writer. Kafka, on the other hand, is a monumental genius. And as you say, he is very much anticipating the kind of bureaucratic structures of the Cold War, also of corporate culture, and of, you know, our current whatever neoliberal capitalism, whatever you want to call it, and I kept thinking about Kafka while I wrote this book, and there is a kind of sense that everyone is just mapping this giant infrastructure that is ultimately unmappable, you know, but they're like Theseus, they're just working their way through these labyrinths with little bits of string and getting it all tangled up and so on, and there's an immense pleasure to that. As you say, it's not all about terror.
Tom McCarthy is the author most recently of Satin Island. He's also General Secretary of the International Necronautical Society, a semi-fictitious avant-garde network. Take this with you into the weekend, why don't you? For most of you, you'll just have to look for the pictures online. The equinox, the spring equinox, coincides with a total eclipse of the sun and a supermoon. Gotta go to Europe to see it for real, but it's too late for that. So you're stuck with reruns of Eclipse Vampires and coming up with your own super moon shenanigans this weekend with no help from the solar system. Good luck with all that. Tell us your story at 877-8MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry, or check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.